We are going to start with the conversation with Blaine Betts, co-founder of Study Mode. Blaine has been the CEO of Study Mode for a while, but he will share with us some updates on that front, recent updates. I met Blaine a little while back and was amazed to hear his story of capital-efficient entrepreneurship. And as you know, from following our work, we are big believers in capital-efficient entrepreneurship. So I invited Blaine to come and, you know, share what he has learned in this process, and also, you know, so that we get a chance to learn from his methodology, his, you know, mechanics of how he has achieved what he has achieved, which is a sizable company with little or no outside financing. So let's start at the beginning. Blaine, when I first spoke with you, I was really impressed by the capital efficiency and the discipline in your process. So tell us about your company, what you do, how you've managed your strategy of, you know, how you've executed so efficiently, and what your thinking is going forward. Let's start with some background information.
Sure, sure. Thanks so much. So basically, Study Mode is a platform for students to share course notes, research, flashcards, any sort of documents, primarily for college students. And we, my co-founder Chris and I started it about 16 years ago. It was really just supposed to be a hobby. We were just having some fun. Of course, we wanted to build a business, but we didn't imagine that it would turn into what it's turned into today. So I think, you know, there were some keys to our early days that are still relevant today. There was always some sort of level of conservatism. Well, really, we didn't make very much money in the beginning. It took us about 5 or 6 years to turn this into a real revenue-generating business. And I think we were unique to have that opportunity because we've never taken investment. So in the early days, we were ad-supported, initially supported by the ad revenue that was going into the initial dot-com boom. But once that crashed, we were ad-supported again through a private advertiser all the way up until around 2004. At that time, we switched to a subscription model. So basically, you could submit a document and get limited access to our site, Study Mode, or you could just pay and get access to everything. And that was a real shift for us in terms of revenue. We actually, around that time, kept our conservative roots for probably a bit too long. It was actually up until, well, let's see, initially from about 2005 to 2007, it was just two of us, and we had gotten revenue to over $1 million with very high margins. And, you know, we were still doing the coding ourselves, most of the design, the product, everything, which I'm not sure if I would do it that way again. I don't think I would. I think we waited too long to build the team, which we actually didn't start building the team until around 2011. And I can go into more detail in any of these areas. But when we started hiring the team, we didn't really know what we were doing. That was about a little over 4 years ago. But we believed in, you know, we really wanted to reinvest in the business and build something more traditional. So anyway, we've been building the team for about 4.5 years, and now we're about 45 people here in Los Angeles. We also now have a team of about 15 people in India. But I'll dive deeper in areas that you'd like. So let me know.
You touched a little bit upon your business model shift from advertising to a subscription model, which you went to a freemium kind of business model, right?
Correct.
So talk to us. Freemium is a very difficult business model to make work and make substantial revenue on. Please talk to us about how your business model works, how you drive conversion, you know, what is free, what is paid, and what experiments. Give us some view into the experiments that went into figuring out what people are willing to pay for. That's of great interest to us.
Sure. So we switched to the freemium model in 2005, and a number of the businesses in our space switched at the same time. Basically, everyone was ad-supported, and a new guy entered the space, and everybody knew each other. It was a very, very small space. But a new guy entered, and instead of being ad-supported, he was charging for access to the research database. And actually, he had some of the sites in the space. I'm sorry. He was advertising on some of the sites in the space, and people were making a lot of money, and people just kind of realized, hey, this guy, this is working pretty well. This must be working pretty well. So our whole space switched from ad-supported to freemium model. And it was a pretty exciting time because, I don't know, people didn't, you know, a lot of people have tried freemium models in a number of spaces that haven't really worked. But for us, it's relatively simple. So you can submit a document and get limited access, which varies for us, actually. Traditionally, that meant you submit a document, you get access to about 5,000 documents on study mode. They weren't necessarily the exact document that you wanted, but 5,000 research topics, you can usually find something that would be helpful. We switched away from that somewhat recently, and we have been trying different models. Like you submit one document and you get access to one, or you submit one and you get access to 10. We're trying to actually just make our users happy. We found that even though we were giving access to 5,000 documents, like I said, it wasn't necessarily the documents that people wanted, and that would turn some users off. So really, it's all about, we're just trying to figure out what makes users happy.
So the basic principle is that users in the community will have to contribute to get access to other people's documents, yes? Other people's lecture exactly. notes, course notes, etc.
Exactly. Correct.
And so what is the pricing model that you, when you, in 2005 you switched to the subscription model, what was the pricing model?
So at that time, let's see, we were, I believe it was $17.95 a month, or like $59.95 for 6 months, something mm-hmm. like that. I can't remember exactly.
How does that play with this contributing documents to get access? Is that the free part? The free part is by contributing documents you get access to documents?
Exactly. So you can contribute and get limited access, or you can just pay and get access to everything.
Unlimited access.
Exactly.
The balance
works out really well. You know, we get a good amount of content, and we get a good amount of users paying. Like the, say, online gaming industry, like Zynga or something like that. It is a very small percentage of users that pay us, but it's enough to have a very sustainable business.
Can you share with us some numbers in terms of how big is the community that you're working with, and what was that size of the community in 2005? What is the size of the community in 2015? How it has grown, and what percentage contributes articles to get access? What percentage pays? Just to give us a feel for what the business is.
Sure. Let's see. So back then, let's just go back to around 2005, 2006, around there. We were around, I'd say, 600,000 monthly active users.
Okay.
During the school year, just on average. Now, through Study Mode and a couple of our international versions of Study Mode, we're at about 60 million monthly active users. So
60 or 16?
60.
60 million. Wow.
Yeah. So a lot's changed since then. And revenue-wise, in 2005, we were probably between $100,000 to $200,000 in revenue. Now we're in the high teens, low 20s. Let's just say like around 20 million in revenue.
And what is the distribution? Like, what percentage of your membership in 2005 was paying members versus now? What is the percent that actually is paying members?
The interesting thing is it's always been very small. It's less than 1%.
Sure. Less than 1%.
Yes. It's a very small percentage. It is a recurring revenue model. So people will join and stay with us for months, sometimes years. But it is a small percentage of users that pay us.
That doesn't surprise me. You know, the entire freemium business has operated on that premise, is that a very, very small percent, really a minuscule percentage actually is willing to pay. There is a huge, free user audience, and then a small percentage that actually converts into paying members. The very tops in the industry, actually Evernote for a while was one of the highest conversion rate businesses in freemium. That was 4%, which was astronomically large. So
that is. We'd be really happy if we could do the same. That is,
but your experience is more the normal premium conversion number. So, folks, those of you who are listening and those of you who are toying with freemium businesses or working with freemium business models, please be aware of the fact that you are going to be working with incredibly low conversion rate numbers, and you have to make the rest of your business, the P&L, work within the constraints of very, very low conversion rate numbers. So, this is a given. I don't know any freemium business that has succeeded in converting at like 10, 20% levels. So please, when you make your assumptions, when you plan your cash flow and so forth, keep this in mind, because, in chasing free users, please do not go out of business, because that it's a tough, tough game. So, Blaine, the next thing I want to explore with you is customer acquisition strategy. How do the free users come to you, and what is the segment? What is the definition of the user base that actually converts into paying customers? What have you learned about them, and how do you acquire more of them?
Mm-hmm. So for many years, including now, we've always been really focused on organic traffic. Google has been great to us. And this is organic free traffic. We have a lot of content, so we have a lot of content listed in Google. People are searching broad terms, things like global warming research, things like that. Very, very long tail. So that's been SEO has been one of our main focuses for many years. And that's been good and bad. It is a blessing and a curse. We're getting a good amount of free traffic, but we also, we're very reliant on Google. And as the algorithm changes, our traffic sometimes changes. So that really fuels some of the ups and downs that we experience as a business that all entrepreneurs are familiar with. So that's been our main focus. We do have large followings on Facebook. We do some Facebook marketing, We in the past, in the earlier sort of Google AdWords days, we did some user acquisition through SEM. We're experimenting with that again, but really for us, organic, you know, a focus on organic traffic has been key for us for many years. A lot of our team go ahead.
I have a question on that. You mentioned that the way you do the free user base, the way you cater to the free user base is you get people to contribute, and that opens up, that kind of unlocks access to, you know, 5,000 pieces of content. How do you do SEO then? What's behind, or what's outside of the walled garden, so to speak, that can draw in organic traffic? Because anything that is within the walled garden, Google cannot index.
Right. So we display a limited amount of each document. I can't remember where we are right now, but we've been experimenting with this a bit. But let's just say we display one to two pages of each document, so the user can get a sense of how, you know, the quality of the document, the writer's style, you know, what the notes look like, you know, things like that. So it's giving Google and the user enough of a feeling of, hey, this is what this document looks like.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. Mm-hmm. All right. So now the rest of my question was, what have you learned about the small percentage of your user base, of the 60 million mm-hmm. users, who actually convert? What are the characteristics of conversion? What kind of users convert typically?
Sure. So these are typically college students. That's who we've always gone after. Really earlier on, the philosophy was, well, college students probably have the ability, you know, at least a number of them will have the ability to pay for our services, you know, the ability to get credit cards. So that was, you know, an earlier philosophy. We do, and these are typically undergraduate college students. We do have a number of students, you know, who are later in life going back to school, mm-hmm. graduate students of all ages, I would say.
Yeah.
We do target high school students as well. We want to familiarize high school students with our brand, you know, as early as possible, and we do that through some of our other products like flashcards. We have advanced placement notes, and we have book notes as well, and those products are all completely free. So we're primarily making money on our research course note database.
Okay. Now, you mm-hmm. Talked a little bit about your team building strategy, and that if you had to do it again, you would do it differently. Talk to us a little bit about how you did it. What was the, you know, evolution of the team from you and your co-founder mm-hmm. in the beginning for many years to what did you add in due course? Where would you have added more if you were redoing the journey?
Mm-hmm. So it started out with just us. We did all of the jobs. We did, you know, coding, design, customer support. I've basically done every job that you can do at my company mm-hmm. at one point or another. Then in around 2007-ish, we hired some developers on Odesk, and that was more of like a mentality shift, like, oh, you know, we're making pretty good money. We can pay people who are frankly better coders than we are to help us build this thing, and we can start focusing on higher and higher level things. So there was that level of building. But when we first decided to build a more traditional team here in Los Angeles, We first hired an assistant, actually, to start taking some of the minor things off of our plate. So that was our first hire. Then we hired a couple of developers. And I wouldn't, you know, we definitely weren't the best developers around. But we had enough knowledge that we felt that we could find some pretty good people. So we used recruiters, actually. I know some people don't like to use recruiters, and some people think they cost too much. But for us at that time, we didn't have a big network, and recruiters were really helpful to us. Mm-hmm. So we started with a couple developers, and from there, our team evolved in just sort of this way, like we felt we needed someone, or one of our other team members were like, hey, you know, we really need to hire this type of person. And what can I say on that? Well, there's one key to that, and there's a book called Rework, written by the founders of Basecamp, and it's a great book for startup founders. But one thing they talk about is hiring when it hurts, and that was something that we did in the early days and still do. You know, it's just building the team as needed, mm-hmm. rather than just, you know, some people, you know, get their satisfaction comes from like, oh, we're this headcount, we're 30 people, we're 40 people, 50, you know, whatever it may be. But really, hiring when it hurts, it's just about, okay, do we really need another developer yet? Do we really need another product person? You know, the Basecamp guys really stress, I believe it's hiring when someone's at about 110%. You know, you don't want to burn someone out. But, you know, wait till the timing's, wait till it's really necessary. So that's kind of how we built our team.
And you're now at 45, yes?
Yes, exactly.
What is the composition? What are the functions of the organization?
So we're actually a very tech and product heavy team. You know, so basically, you know, we've got a decent sized dev team, like 15 to 20 people here in Los Angeles. You know, throw in product and design, you're getting into the mid 30s there. We've got, you know, some SEO folks. We've got some operational people, as well as, you know, we have, you know, typical like office manager. We have a customer support person. But
the content is entirely user generated, right? There's no content that you're producing in-house.
That's correct. That's correct. We do have some curated content, some content we've acquired or had written. Like our AP notes or our book notes, but otherwise, you know, 99.9% of our content is user generated.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of where you are today, one thing you mentioned that you have made a major management change. You may want to talk mm-hmm. about that, and I'm curious to hear what is the thought process around Study Mode today, your capitalization. So far, you're completely self-financed. What is the long-term thinking in your organization today?
Sure. So, let's see. So, my co-founders and I ran the business ourselves for about a little over 15 years. And I give us credit. I do give us credit for being able to take it from, you know, three guys working out of a house to a 40-something person company. So we were able to make that transition just through having great advisors, great team. You know, a lot of people helped, but we still hadn't taken capital. We still don't have like a formal board. A lot of pieces that traditional businesses have. So we made that transition nicely. About 8 months ago at this point, I did hire a president to help us out. His name is Thomas. And he has very complementary background as well as just more experience than we do. So he most recently was at savings.com. He was there pre and post acquisition to, he was the president there, and they sold it to Cox Media Group. He was at a company called Razor Gator earlier in his career, which was going head to head against StubHub, and actually lost that battle. You know, StubHub won, but he's got experience around raising a lot of money. He sold some businesses, just areas that we just don't have, you know, experience in. And anyway, what I learned after hiring him was he had more experience in almost every area than we do. So I've kind of, for the last 8 months, taken a back seat. I was still in office for quite a while, but these last few months, I kind of just let him really step into his leadership. And yesterday, I actually handed over the CEO reins to him as well. And I just really got to a place where, you know, did it for 16 years. It was wonderful in so many ways. And at the same time, I realized I really like contributing at a high level. I like being involved. And yet having new energy plus more experience has been just fantastic for the organization. So anyway, at this point I'm formally the executive chairman, and Thomas is just running with it as CEO and president.
And are you thinking about raising money, or do you want to sell the company at this point? What would you like to see happen? What would the management team like to see happen?
So ever since we professionalized the business, you know, starting 3 or 4 years ago, I've had a lot of conversations with investors, but we still have a great amount of cash flow. We're still happy with where things are, and we're not necessarily looking for a partner. I do believe that investors can add, you know, the right investors can add a lot of value beyond the money. So we're always open-minded to that, but it's not something we're actively pursuing yet. We'll see what happens. I mean,
so
our sort of vision, yeah.
Before you go on, I just want to, you know, discuss one, you know, this decision is a decision that a lot of people who have bootstrapped successful businesses face, right? And and if you contrast your situation with Evernote's situation, for example, Evernote has built a very interesting company with serious conversion rates on a freemium business and so forth. But in my opinion, it's a highly overcapitalized company. And if you put that much pressure, that much growth pressure, that much valuation pressure on a business that has such low conversion rates, it actually becomes an unsustainable situation. So
this is
something you should take note of. You know, in your decision of raising money or not, don't put yourself in a position that sets you up to fail where you have already succeeded. Now you make a set of decisions that puts artificial level of growth pressure on the business and basically screws it up.
We are cautious with that. You have to be careful. You know, we've seen even businesses in our space like Chegg, who raised a ton of money, has had a hard time. But, you know, they seem to be figuring a number of things out. But I know it's been, you know, they raised so much money, they went public, and it's been a rough journey. And, you know, referencing sort of the gaming space again, a friend of mine said to me once about Zynga, he said, you know, maybe they just weren't meant to be a multi-billion dollar company. You know, they could have been very happy at a certain level. And then when you know, everybody wants to go bigger, but when you shoot for the stars and don't quite make it, it can be very, very hard. It's something we're conscious of.
You've talked about Basecamp earlier, the founders of Basecamp. Mm-hmm. One of the founders of Basecamp recently wrote a very powerful article called Reconsider. And all of you in the audience, if you haven't read this piece, you must read this piece. It's a really powerful pause button that this guy has pushed on the industry and asked people to think about what you want. What is the definition of success? And as far as I'm concerned, the definition of success is not to grow at all costs in unsustainable ways and then implode. That is not success. So, you know, coming back to our first principle, our principle here is that entrepreneurship equals customers, revenues, and profits. Financing and exit are optional. So by that definition, you are running a successful business. Don't make decisions that are going to turn a successful business into a failure. There's no need to do that. But many entrepreneurs out there are somehow feeling this pressure to become a unicorn, to become a multi-billion dollar company. No, that's not a reasonable benchmark for success. You know, that's an artificial benchmark that the media is imposing, that the venture capitalists are imposing. That is not a definition of success. So this is, you know, the reason I'm kind of dialoguing on this issue is for all of your benefits who are sooner or later going to have to deal with these decisions and these choices. Don't overcapitalize the company and put pressure on yourself to grow at a level that your business cannot sustain. That is a very critical decision.